hope we haven't lost the spell of the Egon in 2 weeks. We've had other good opportunities in the meanwhile. Wonderful evening with Mr. Hoffman, and then the Ascension, commemoration of the Ascension of Baha'u'llah. Now, I want to take the opportunity again, like we did last time. We're coming up to the second part. I don't remember what the last page of quotations was we read, but it was somewhere in the 80s, I think. Does someone have a note of what we read last? Page 81. What I'd like to say is that, again, anything in part one or the second half of part one, but if you have things going back to the beginning also that you want to raise now before we go on, any questions or clarifications that we might have something on, please feel free to do so. Have you been reading again? Have you stopped reading for 2 weeks? So, since you understand it all, maybe I should ask you some questions. Is that right? In the outline, the last part of this, if we look at the outline of part one from page 80, the subjects that I found there were was the position of the divines, in general their position in the different dispensations, and then the objections and differences that persist in every age, 81 to 83, the alleged corruption of the texts, 83 to 90, then this marvelous passage about the everlasting morn is breaking. And later an exhortation to the people of the Bayan. Taking up the theme of corruption of the books. A note on that here that I'd like to share with you. On page 83, we find that, again, a reference here, they confidently assert, middle of page 83, they confidently assert that such traditions as indicate the advent of the expected Qayyim have not yet been fulfilled, whilst they themselves have failed to inhale the fragrance of the meaning of these traditions and are still oblivious of the fact that all the signs foretold have come to pass, that the way of God's holy cause hath been revealed and the concourse of the faithful, swift as lightning, are even now passing upon that way, whilst these foolish divines wait expecting to witness the signs foretold. Say, O ye foolish ones, wait ye even as those before you are waiting. Which would seem to be a reference to past dispensations also. On the page just before that, referring to the divines as they have literally interpreted the word of God in the sayings and traditions of the letters of unity. Presumably these letters of unity are, that's a title in traditional scriptures, Islamic scriptures, to the 12 imams. If you want to make a note of that, letters of unity there. And expounded them according to their own deficient understanding, they have therefore deprived themselves and all their people of the bountiful showers of the grace and mercies of God. And yet they bear witness to this well-known tradition. Verily, our word is abstruse, bewilderingly abstruse. In another instance, it is said, our cause is sorely trying, highly perplexing. None can bear it except a favorite of heaven, or an inspired prophet, or he whose faith God has tested. Now Baha'u'llah goes on. He says, these leaders of religion admit that none of these three specified conditions is applicable to them. The first two conditions are manifestly beyond their reach. They're not favorites of heaven nor inspired prophets. So as to the third, it's evident that at no time have they been proof against those tests that have been sent by God, and that when the divine touchstone appeared, they have shown themselves to be naught but dross. At the bottom again now of 83, were they to be questioned concerning those signs that must needs herald the revelation and rise of the son of the Mohammedan dispensation, to which we have already referred, none of which have been literally fulfilled, and were it to be said to them, wherefore have ye rejected the claims advanced by Christians and the peoples of other faiths, and regard them as infidels, knowing not what answer to give, they will reply, these books have been corrupted, and are not, and never have been of God. Now it's the same problem. They're saying there's certain things in our books. The Bab hasn't fulfilled them. He can't be the promised one. Finished. Then now Baha'u'llah is saying, if you point out to the Muslims and you say, well, what about these promises in Judaism and Christianity that are supposed to be fulfilled for the next prophet? And they weren't fulfilled literally or outwardly by Muhammad. Then they will answer and they will say, that's because their books are corrupted. That's the way we get over that problem. Say the books are no good. So he's saying, reflect. The words of the verses themselves eloquently testify that it's to the truth that they are of God. A similar verse hath been also revealed in the Quran, were ye of them that comprehend. Verily I say, throughout all this period, they have utterly failed to comprehend what is meant by corrupting the text. Then he goes on to talk about this altering of the text. Now this explanation Baha'u'llah gives of the meaning of corruption or modification, tahrif in Persian, of the text has particular significance for those of Islamic background, this explanation. For it's as a result of the misinterpretation of certain Quranic verses that the Muslims have gradually come to believe that the existing texts of the Old and New Testaments are without value and have been corrupted beyond recognition. This point of view is forcefully countered by Baha'u'llah, who sets down the true meaning of a few instances where modification of the verses has been mentioned. One of them is the story that's here of Ibn Suriyah. He explains the historical context for the Quranic verse 445, where in the Quran it says, they pervert the text of the word of God. By corruption of the text, Baha'u'llah then states, is meant the interpretation of God's holy book in accordance with idle imaginings and vain desires. It does not mean the actual words of revelation have been effaced. This is further explanation of the notes here. This is not to deny, however, there are questions related to attribution and authenticity with regard to the biblical books and the passages in the Bible that are treated by modern scholarship. We don't deny that as Baha'is, but we don't say that the whole thing has been corrupted. It's a question of authenticity and if they've collected the right fragments and so on. This goes on, talks about distortion after hearing the word, the meaning of corruption, and then this supposed non-existence of a genuine gospel. We want to look into that in detail. On page 89, there's a reference here. It says, in support of the same argument, he says, we have also heard a number of the foolish of the earth assert that the genuine text of the heavenly gospel doth not exist amongst the Christians, that it hath ascended unto heaven. How grievously they have erred. How oblivious of the fact that such a statement imputeth the gravest injustice and tyranny to a gracious and loving providence. How could God, when once the day star of the beauty of Jesus had disappeared from the sight of his people and ascended unto the fourth heaven, cause his holy book, his most great testimony amongst his creatures, to disappear also? What would be left to that people to cling to from the setting of the day star of Jesus until the rise of the sun of the Mohammedan dispensation? What law could be their stay and guide? How could such people be made the victims of the avenging wrath of God, the omnipotent avenger? How could they be afflicted with the scourge of chastisement by the heavenly King? Above all, how could the flow of the grace of the All-Bountiful be stayed? How could the ocean of his tender mercies be stilled? Then he finishes this argument, "We take refuge with God from that which his creatures have fancied about him. Exalted is he above their comprehension." Again, the whole movement, thrust of this argument is for those Muslims that they believe that the texts have been effaced, corrupted, or ascended. At least there's nothing there. All of this is to bring back this argument that Baha'u'llah is using, that in all the dispensations, in every dispensation, there have been references in the holy books to things that would happen at the coming of the Promised One, which were not literally fulfilled. They have a spiritual significance. And it happened with Islam. He's telling this uncle of the Bab, it happened with Islam, as well as in this day it's happening now with the arguments of the divines and the Muslims against the appearance of the Qayyim. When he's come, and all of his signs, he affirms here, have been fulfilled in one way or another. But you need the Prophet of God to explain these, the fulfillment of prophecy. The interpretation of these things is not open to the people. You need a Prophet to explain after his coming. Very hard to be able to foresee the coming through the prophecies. But once you've accepted, and this is interesting, it isn't that you accept because of the prophecies, it's because you accept because of the impact of the new revelation. And then the new revelation educates you with regard to how it connects with the previous dispensations. At least this is the process that I've seen. It's usually not through prophecy that people will come to the faith, but by the attraction of the faith in itself. Fourth heaven, what's this fourth heaven? Which one do you suppose Khomeini has gone to? God forgive us for mentioning his name here. No, that's all right. I'll stand by that comment. No problem. Fourth heaven. They have a letter from the Guardian written on his behalf. It says, "As to the ascent of Christ to the fourth heaven, as revealed in the glorious book of Egon, he stated that the fourth heaven is a term," in other words, the Guardian, "is a term used and a belief held by the early astronomers. The followers of the Shia sect likewise held this belief. As the Kitab-i Egan was revealed for the guidance of that sect, this term was used in conformity with the concepts of its followers." That's dated 23 February 1945. "In the ancient scheme of the seven heavens or spheres, the sun was located in the fourth heaven." There's another reference to this in the Egan on page 133. You may want to cross-reference that with the one on this page. "Son of man, they at last heaped on his blessed person such woes that he took his flight unto the fourth heaven." This is the old idea that the earth was flat and there were these crystalline half globes, one over the other, that held the stars and the planets and the moon and so on, one within the other. And they moved, God moved these things, that's what gave the movement to the spheres. But they really believed them to be solid, at least this was one of the beliefs. There were various stages of solid crystalline shapes. Well, it's before the inception of modern science, before Galileo. It was fairly universally held. Now, there are things in the Quran that indicate that they the earth revolves around the sun, but they, Muslims, didn't refer to that very much. And when they did, they said it was it had to be interpreted properly to be understood, because of course science hadn't come to discover that this was the case. Although I think there are tablets of Baha'u'llah where it says that there were those who earlier affirmed this, after Bahatu, earlier affirmed this, the solar center rather than the geocentric model. I have to look back into those. I don't have the quotes here. In the passages regarding Muhammad's night journey, he ascends through the seven heavens, up to the seventh heaven, which is the highest stage of the invisible realm, Shoghi Effendi refers to it. And there he witnessed the glory of God behind a thousand veils of light. And the glory of God spoke to him, so on. So you get again this image of the seven heavens. Now when, in the account of Enoch's ascent into the heavens, there's an ancient account of those. Also there's seven heavens there. And he describes in each heaven one of the prophets or manifestations of God seated on a throne of light in the center of that heaven, and all things revolving in that heaven around his center where he was. And then you ascend into the next realm, which is above that, the throne on high, above the throne below, the next stage. And there are various accounts, but he's placed Adam on one throne and Moses or Abraham and then Moses, different ones. So Jesus would come out fourth heaven there, so to speak. And then you'd have Muhammad on the fifth and the Bab and Baha'u'llah going up in that kind of an order, if you projected that on further on. That raises an interesting question about what does Baha'u'llah mean when he says that he has come to unite all who are in the heavens and on the earth? Has there been some particular heaven for the various religions of the past? Or have they all been united together in the other realm? Or has Baha'u'llah actually performed this function both in this world and the next? It will be interesting to see what that is. Because this is this tremendous truth that all of them wanted to come back to the world at this time, or wanted to serve the saints and heroes of the past. So perhaps there's unfolding truth in the other worlds too. Surely there's nothing, there's motion is life, so motion, one of the laws of motion is the acquisition of further understanding and expanded vision. So it's something that's moving in our own lives and no doubt in the lives of those who are in the spiritual realms. We can't think of it as a fixed, stagnant position that they've attained grace. Finished. This is not the concept that's in the writings and in the tablets about this. It's a very dynamic, ongoing experience, discovery. All right. Any comments or thoughts about that or questions? Are you sure? Please.
When you talk about uniting the heavens and the earth, I thought it was just not aiming at exactly the heavens and the earth, just what it's saying, that it comes to unite everybody. I thought it was just a sort of a different understanding.
Perhaps it is. Perhaps it is. As I say, it just has this, to me it has this, to me personally, it has this kind of suggestive quality when you think of these other heavens and other realms. It doesn't literally mean physical heavens, because Baha'u'llah is the universal manifestation, we're told by Shoghi Effendi, for this planet. But we see the possibility of perhaps manifestations coming in the future that would unite various planets together. I don't know how that works. That's still for other universal cycles of the future. But if this plan of progressive unification works in the universe, one would imagine that it would project through the solar system and eventually intergalactically. So how, what? Mr. Olinga told me, he heard the Guardian say here that before such things would take place, mankind would have to conform much closer to the laws and the demands of the love of God. That was the key to the discovery of these things. Interestingly enough. It's a pilgrim note, but it's a nice one. Interesting. It doesn't harm anybody. To conform to the requirements of the love of God. In other words, the love of God, the stages of the love of God, it has a revealing power. As we draw closer to God, there is a revealing power that corresponds with that. The more we love God, the more we understand, the more we penetrate the meanings of existence and life. There's probably, this is probably being enacted at several levels. There's probably the universal, which then encompasses the particular of the individual planets. We have a few indications in tablets. Abdu'l-Baha was asked, what is it when Baha'u'llah says that every sun hath its planets and every planet hath its creatures, whose numbers no man can compute or calculate. He was asked about that, and Abdu'l-Baha said, by creatures, what is meant by creatures? He says, by creatures is meant those creatures that have volition. And it implies the existence of human souls in all the planets, which would be what you're saying, In some answered questions, he speaks about this subject too. And he says that man exists from the beginning in the planets. Even though there's no appearance of him, he's there. The human spirit potentially is there. Now there's all these stages that the planets evolve through, and how can we know anything about the creatures in those planets? Abdu'l-Baha said we can know something about them by the light that they emit, that's reflected from them, the things that we can see, that we can understand. By the stars at the center of planetary systems, we can understand something about that planetary system. And he said this way back, turn of the century or something. Now, of course, since then have discovered how to measure the radiation or whatever it's called, the rays from these various bodies. So we'll have to see in the future. But there's another thing we know is that suns and planets are born and die. So when we say it hath creatures, potentially it has creatures, perhaps they haven't appeared, or perhaps the planet is in a state of decay and disintegration. We don't know. So this is obviously we have to take into balance when looking at that, the evolutionary pattern that we see.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would tend to destroy the argument of a greater manifestation coming to unite planets, because they would each be in different stages.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, there are areas in the world where we don't live because they're not inhabitable. It doesn't mean there aren't people other places. In other words, presumably the solar systems are established in such a way that there is some parallel development in those planets. Now, we say, how we've had sent up these rocket ships and we have this news and that news and there's no anything, and the fact that human beings couldn't survive on that in those worlds. How could they survive? We can't survive as far as we know. The temperatures are too grave or too cold or too hot. But Abdu'l-Baha in a tablet has said that the creatures in these distant worlds are made or are created in conformity with the chemical composition of those worlds, which then means that there must be a whole variety of ways that the human soul can embody itself to be able to have the experiences it needs to become a reborn soul, so to speak. Yes, please. Yes. Yeah, that's a lovely thought too. It's a very lovely thought. In other words, the uniting of earth and heaven is something that has a meaning on the planetary level with the spiritual worlds in general. And it also has the very particular individual meaning. We have come to unite the earth and the heavens. That is, you and your physical being with the spiritual, unseen spiritual heavenly reality, which is your true being. So that's the earth of you and the heaven of you that are going to be united. Yeah. So it obviously would have a, you know, could have a range of meaning. I think so. And isn't that exactly what Baha'u'llah does here? He cites even that verse, or very similar verses, in a couple of spots here. In the Iqan himself, in support of the argument. What does this mean then, so to speak? Yeah. That's important. But you know, when you're blind, when you want to be blind, I mean, like you can point out all kinds of things in the Gospel, the Christians, if they're fixed in their position, they're not receptive. They just don't see the point of what you're making, or even if you make it, it's not convenient for them to notice. This is something that's different from the East and the West, I think, that there was a certain integrity of rationality and reasoning and argument in the East, which required, if you were in authority, you had to be, you were probably one of the people that could argue the best. You know, you could establish your case over anybody else's understanding, and the rest of the people around would agree with you. And if a person was then in a face down with a priest or something, and that priest was more powerful, more eloquent, and more reasoned, and had a greater range of quotations memorized to bring to bear on any subject, then he was obviously the mujtahid, he was the supreme authority. You could challenge him, but you'd have to outdo him to assume his position. Otherwise, you were under his authority. Now, this arose in Baha'i meetings, where some of these mujtahids would be defeated by Baha'is in argument. And they would become Baha'is because of it. You know, the priests would become Baha'is. Because there was nothing else left. I mean, otherwise, it would be shameful if you were defeated to just say, well, that's your opinion, you know. But in the West, if you press someone with arguments in the West right against the wall, they'll slip right out. And they won't like you afterwards. They won't appreciate that you have pressed them to this embarrassing position. And far from realizing that they should accept your point of view because there's no other point of view that you can think of which is better, they don't respond that way, neither in Europe nor in America. So when the first Persians came to the West, they were using these arguments to press people into a position where they found that, you know, the Christians didn't know the Bible, and I mean, they didn't care about these arguments. They didn't have enough power, you know. It wasn't the center of their consciousness the way it was in the minds of the Iranians. Not that they were acting on their religion, but the parts of it were the texture, if you will, of their intellectual life. And they could be drawn into argument and defeated, and then they would win Baha'is out of it. I don't know if any of you ever had an experience of defeating a non-Baha'i in an argument and having them become Baha'is on the spot? No. In other words, it's only through loving explanation, through exhortation, through loving explanation, through drawing people into a vision, into seeing what the cause is from the Baha'i point of view, not being argumentative, not pressing. In fact, if you're contradicted, and just become quiet, he says, you know, and pray. Don't argue. Don't enter into contention with people. I mean, it's tempting sometimes to say, but can't you? Don't you? You just said this, and I just said this, and that's the answer. Can't you see that the answer? You know. No. And then he says, pray for the people. Really, pray for the people. So you, the approach is very different. It's not just to, you have to woo the hearts. You have to breathe spirit into the hearts of people. Dear friend, now when the light of God's, page 90, now when the light of God's everlasting morn is breaking, when the radiance of His holy words, God is the light of the heavens and of the earth, is shedding illumination upon all mankind, when the inviolability of His tabernacle is being proclaimed by His sacred utterance, God hath willed to perfect His light, and the hand of omnipotence bearing His testimony, in His grasp He holdeth the kingdom of all things as being outstretched unto all the peoples and kindreds of the earth. It behooveth us to gird up the loins of endeavor, that haply by the grace and bounty of God we may enter the celestial city. Verily we are God's, and abide within the exalted habitation, and unto Him we do return. Then, this is one of these statements that we were talking about earlier, that Baha'u'llah peppers, if you will, the first part of the Igan with this. He drops into the argument. He's been going along with this reasoned argument, and then suddenly it's just as if he's overwhelmed by the appearance of this new day of God. And he'll announce something like this to him. We've had a number of passages like this. This goes on. He says, it's incumbent upon thee by the permission of God to cleanse the eye of thine heart from the things of the world, that thou mayest realize the infinitude of divine knowledge, and mayest behold truth so clearly that thou wilt need no proof to demonstrate His reality, nor any evidence to bear witness unto His testimony. Notice here that truth with a capital T is used as a synonym of God. Truth. The truth. Al-Haq in Persian, Arabic. The true one, in other words. And may enter the celestial city. The whole subject of celestial city is taken up in the second part of the book. We'll be coming to it with a detailed explanation. It's really the Word of God. It's entering into the spiritual dimensions of the Word of God, and the main implication of it. But there's quite a detailed explanation about it. What about the eye of the heart? Did you know your heart had an eye? What state is it in if you've got it? Is it open? Is it closed? Is it blurred? Is it... Throughout the Baha'i writings, you find references to two ways of seeing, both to an inner and outer eye. This inner vision or inspired insight associated with the eye of thine heart must needs be cleansed of earthly things and directed towards that knowledge shining from the Word of God, the light of truth, the light of the true one. Consider the following well-known admonition. O man of two visions, close one eye and open the other. Close one to the world and all that is therein, and open the other to the hallowed beauty of the Beloved. Two ways of seeing. So from the Hidden Words, the Persian Hidden Word number 12. This next paragraph sets forth three distinct degrees of divine recognition. We'll read it and then think about it a little bit. O affectionate seeker, shouldst thou soar in the holy realm of the Spirit, thou wouldst recognize God manifest and exalted above all things, in such wise that thine eyes would behold none else beside Him. God was alone, there was none else beside Him. So lofty is this station that no testimony can bear it witness, neither evidence do justice to its truth. So that's the first one. The second one. Wert thou to explore the sacred domain of truth, thou wilt find that all things are known only by the light of His recognition, that He hath ever been and will continue forever to be known through Himself. And the third one. And if thou dwellest in the land of testimony, content thyself with that which He Himself hath revealed. Is it not enough for them that we have sent down unto thee the book? This is the testimony which He Himself hath ordained. Greater proof than this there is none, nor ever will be. This proof is His word, His own self, the testimony of His truth. So we have the holy realm of spirit, in which the soul beholding naught but God is free from the need for lesser testimonies. We have the sacred domain of truth, where the knowledge of all things depends on His recognition. And finally, the land of testimony, where the seeker contents himself with the proof of the book. In a sense, these three perspectives may be said to parallel the three stages of certitude alluded to by Baha'u'llah. In a later stage, let's see, we'll find a reference on page 196. Stations of absolute certitude. These stations or degrees of certitude are known traditionally in Islam as three stages of certitude. The certitude of knowing, that is to know, for example, and hear about fire. To know and hear about fire, okay? The certitude of knowing. The certitude of seeing, to see fire. Not to know and to hear about it, but actually see it. And the light of certitude, to experience burning, if you will, in this analogy that they give. One is to, you've heard all about it. Okay, you could say, you've heard about the sea. If you don't like the burning one. I think Sandy didn't like the burning one. If you hear about the sea, and then you see the sea, and then you swim in the sea. Three different stages of assurance about
that. That's like in Seven Valleys, when he's speaking about the grammarian and the
it's in there. It's in there. Well, it's this question. That, in other words, there are stages in this, you know. And there are stages in our recognition of the faith the same way. We hear it, we like it. Then we begin to witness the lights of it. And then we become penetrated, suffused with the light of the faith. There's stages and degrees in this that were promised, and in the certitude that we'll have. Now he talks about the certitude, and he talks about how you have to cleanse your eye and your ear of all human influences, so that the word of God speaks to you directly. In other words, it interacts in your soul with a soul that's tranquil, detached, purified, and pulsing and receptive to the impulses of the words of God. And the Word of God then contains latently all this energy which can activate these potential forces of the names of God which are in our being and which constitute really our being, our own character, our own particular quality or characteristic. And finally, Baha'u'llah has been addressing the uncle of the Bab. He changes mode here a little bit. And he says, and now we beseech the people of the Bayan, all the learned, the sages, the divines and witnesses amongst them, not to forget the wishes and admonitions revealed in their book. Let them at all times fix their gaze upon the essentials of His cause, lest when He, who is the quintessence of truth, the inmost reality of all things, the source of all light, is made manifest. They cling unto certain passages of the book and inflict upon him that which was inflicted in the dispensation of the Quran. Now notice here, these are titles of Baha'u'llah, given by Baha'u'llah himself, with regard to the one who is to appear. The quintessence of truth, the inmost reality of all things, the source of all light. Three titles of Baha'u'llah you'll find right here. Then he goes on, for verily, powerful is he, the king of divine might, to extinguish with one letter of his wondrous words the breath of life in the whole of the Bayan and the people thereof, and with one letter bestow upon them a new and everlasting life, and cause them to arise and speed out of the sepulchres of their vain and selfish desires. He has made his words to be the vehicle of the breath of life. That's what he's telling us here. He can also take that vitality away from those words so that there are nothing left but dead letters. In other words, he has bonded something spiritually in a mysterious way. When we read these prayers, when we read these words, there's something that acts on us because it's the quality of this word. Now he's telling them we take it away from the Bayan. We can. Powerful is he, the king of divine might, to extinguish this breath of life. Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l Baha says that they, while they are abrogated, those systems, said their influence continues in the world. He does speak about this in several places, but we don't know in what way it influences the effect of the cause of Christ and his words, how it still influences the world. But as a very vital religion, as a religion per se, we have other statements of the Master which say that there's nothing left but an imitation as far as what the people possess. But you can't limit the effects, the long and far-reaching effects of any single revelation, because there's spiritual energies and forces involved. I would think it would be hard to do that. But this is one of these points where you've got two contrasting statements that you can reconcile. From one vantage point, they're all dead and gone. From another, the life that they pour into the world never ceases. But it finds its fullest expression now in Baha'u'llah's revelation. Or maybe those books have vitality for those that have accepted Baha'u'llah and have ceased really to animate in the same way. Because we get much more excited about the Quran and the Bible than the Christians or the Muslims ever do, you know. We really do. We see more in them. We understand what they're for. We see them in their true light. Very different from the way they're viewed by the followers of the past religions. Maybe that has something to say. It's an interesting question to think about, and as you're reading in other passages and other tablets, see what the proper answer might be. I certainly don't think one can jump to a quick answer to a question like that.
Why has so little of the Bab's writings been translated?
Because Abdu'l Baha said that the Bab's writing shouldn't be published until Baha'u'llah's cause is raised up in the world. Then they can be published. It's because of the iconoclastic character of the Bab's revelation is very challenging. It was very severe. It's very challenging. And the enemies of the faith would use it against us. They would say, look, these are the people that believe this. Do you believe that? And they're like, no, I can't believe that. Well, how can I be a Baha'i then? How can you be a Baha'i? It's from that point of view. You'll see some of the severe things that Baha'u'llah in his tablets have eliminated. They have a root in the Bab's writings. You know? Now, why is that? Because he had to make a split. And there's another tablet of Abdu'l Baha where he says these laws were never intended to be acted on. They were revealed. From that, I understand, my personal understanding, they were revealed to shake and test people by the reading of them, to tremble, not to act on. And they weren't acted on. They were superseded by Baha'u'llah shortly thereafter. And they serve the purpose. That, I mean, imagine the clergy read it and the others read it, they just shake with it. God has many faces. Some of them, you know, He's the face of the divine avenger. He's got other faces too. But all of it has a divine meaning. All of it has, in the end, has a merciful meaning. He says if His justice surpassed His mercy, nothing would be left on the face of the earth. It's just, thank heavens His mercy is greater than His justice. He goes on to say, and be watchful and remember that all things have their consummation in belief in Him, in attainment unto His day, and in the realization of His divine presence. Then he quotes from the Quran. He says, there is no piety in turning your faces toward the east or toward the west, but he is pious who believeth in God in the last day. Give ear, O people of the Bayan, unto the truth whereunto we have admonished you, that haply ye may seek the shelter of the shadow extended in the day of God upon all mankind. Which brings us to part two on page 97. There's no explanation. I mean, there are a few themes that are distinct in the two parts. The Book of Sirtuz is, as we have seen, divided into two parts. Each is headed by a brief paragraph which sets forth its general theme. Part 1 centers on the importance of detachment in attaining to true understanding of God and His prophets, an account of the cruelty suffered by the divine messengers, the consequences of man blindly following religious leaders and not searching out truth for themselves, the exalted station of the manifestations of God, the method of God in trying His servants to distinguish the sincere from the false, and the relativity of religious truth as well as the continuity of divine revelation. Now the second part, there's a summary here that we have too. No, this is just a summary based on analysis of it. The second part of the text centers on the sovereignty of the manifestations of God and their mysterious twofold nature. It also unravels the inner meaning of numerous abstruse scriptural terms and finally demonstrates the validity of the mission of the Bab and his revelation. It's an analytical summary. I'll be giving you a list now of the themes from God Passes By as they appear in the Igan in a subsequent class. And there it's divided, showing which themes are in part one and which themes are in part two. And some of the themes are actually representative in both, that appear in both. So to read this opening paragraph, now listen to the sense, because this is the essence of this. These opening paragraphs are in Arabic. The rest of the text is Persian with some Arabic sprinkled in and a few small, short passages, but most of it's Persian. Verily, he who is the day star of truth and revealer of the Supreme Being holdeth for all time undisputed sovereignty over all that is in heaven and on earth. so no man be found on earth to obey him. He verily is independent of all earthly dominion, though he be utterly destitute. Thus we reveal unto thee the mysteries of the cause of God, and bestow upon thee the gems of divine wisdom, that haply thou mayest soar on the wings of renunciation to those heights that are veiled from the eyes of men. Now, one of the problems of the uncle of the Bab is that the Qa'im is supposed to conquer everything. He's supposed to establish his throne on the world and rule over all. He's supposed to raise up an army, a host. And the uncle of the Bab was asking Baha'u'llah, you say that the Bab is the Qa'im, but what about these things? And here Baha'u'llah is setting this forth, the position of the day star of truth. And he gives various examples of how they were destitute, how they suffered, how they were humiliated. He's been, of course, talking about that in part one as well. And yet, these are still the manifestations. In the case of the uncle of the Bab, he could cite the case of Muhammad and of the 12 Imams. If they were from God, why didn't they rule over everybody? Is it a sign of weakness? Is it a sign of that they are not from God because they are subjected to the cruelty of the people? Or that they get sick? Or that they get injured and die? Does this prove they're not divine in character? Now he's pointing out here, he says, even though no one be found to obey him, it doesn't make him any less what he is. Though he be utterly destitute. And he says, these are the mysteries of the cause of God. How mysterious. And he gives all kinds of examples here, how he tests the people through these things. Now, after he's given this in Arabic, now he gives a Persian explanation of those verses which he's revealed in Arabic. And he says, the significance and essential purpose underlying these words is to reveal and demonstrate unto the pure in heart and the sanctified in spirit that they who are the luminaries of truth and the mirrors reflecting the light of divine unity, in whatever age and cycle they are sent down from their invisible habitations of ancient glory unto this world, to educate the souls of men and endue with grace all created things, are invariably endowed with an all-compelling power and invested with invincible sovereignty. Sir.
He's explaining why the Bab is a manifestation, why the Bab should be accepted as a manifestation. He himself hasn't revealed himself as a manifestation. He said, do you reveal and should be the mystery of the cause of God? If he is revealing the verses of God, wouldn't
distract
anybody who's reading this to say,
well,
he says
he's
a manifestation.
Well, the signs are pretty clear throughout the book that he's how does he get the power to make these explanations, you know, for one thing? Where is this authority upon which he's now suddenly speaking forth all of these divine truths? You'd think some of them would have caught on, and of course I think some of them did, but actually, the uncle of the Bab didn't only recognize the Bab, he recognized Baha'u'llah through this book. So that's not its first purpose, yet it's the outcome for all of us. Now we find out that these luminaries of truth are sent down from their invisible habitations of ancient glory unto this world. What does that mean? Sent down into this world. In the book High Endeavors on page 71, there's a letter cited from Shoghi Effendi, written on his behalf, which says, among other things, the prophets, unlike us, are pre-existent. The soul of Christ existed in the spiritual world before his birth in this world. We cannot imagine what that world is like, so words are inadequate to picture his state of being. Now, there are other letters, perhaps you're familiar with, where Shoghi Effendi states that the human soul comes into being at the moment of conception. The souls of the Prophet, unlike human souls, are pre-existent. They exist before conception. In one of the tablets of the Bab, you'll have to take this as a pilgrim note because it's not published and translated, but just as a story to tell you. There's a tablet of the Bab in which he's written to the divines to explain what are the things that are going to happen to him, to them, in the future, the Shia divines. And he says, and some of you maybe have heard me quote this, he says, ere the moment I chose to appear in my mother's womb, I repaired, I went and visited with Muhammad, and we discussed your future. The Persian divines. And he talks there about how they will humiliate themselves and so on. And then it talks about a period in which they will oppress the cause of God, and that they will rise in ascendancy, very high, in order that they can be thrown down very low. And he says these are the stages of the future. Now, you see the Bab's reality sitting there talking with, or whatever, I don't know, lying there, or whatever, they are, they're together with Muhammad's reality, and they're having this conversation about these divines. Please. Okay. What's it? Please. There's an explanation from the master in some answered questions. Says this refers to the physical individuality of the manifestation. They have three parts to them. They have the physical, they have the soul, which is pre-existent, and they have the supernal truth, that effulgence that's completely wedded with that soul from the beginning. It doesn't come later. They are aware, Abdu'l-Bahá says, of the mysteries of existence from the very beginning of their lives. Now, their mission is to awaken them. And he likens this to a man who is asleep and then wakes up. The same man, but he's sleeping, you don't know what he has to say. When he wakes up, he speaks. So we have the manifestation awakening the divine mission in the God awakening the divine mission in the manifestation at a certain point in his life, in which then he takes on another character. He's been quiet, now he speaks out. And Baha'u'llah received that in the Sayyid Shah, that change, and the Bab prior to his declaration. And who could see the signs of this revelation in them, even from childhood. And that's why we have the story of the wonders of the childhood of the prophets, you know? Various incidents like Christ speaking to the scribes in the temple and when he was a child. The wonders that people would hear from. I think that's the explanation of that. I just read it in a letter from the House of Justice. Actually, there's a letter going out. Somebody asked this question. Who else is back there? Someone else had asked? Yes, please.
So we know that we will have a progressive life in the next world. And if we can imagine progress, it's really time. Suddenly there has to be some time that we don't have to attain virtues, and then you're going to gain them in the future. So all these things can be explained.
There doesn't seem to be any way to explain progression in the other world without time, because we have no way to understand it. He said it's not possible for us to comprehend what it means that there's time is not the same as here. And yet there is sequence of events, if you will. It's a mysterious thing. I suppose we'll have to wait till the next world before we can understand that in the best fashion. Now, the other thing is that nothing comes from nothing. The soul must come from somewhere, but not as an individual reality capable of self-consciousness. In other words, it's, if you will, a world spirit of a resource for human souls. But when conception takes place, you have this fixing of an individuality with the potential for consciousness of God at an individual level. And that seems to endure then. Now the other thing is, he says, possess a pure, kindly, and radiant heart, that thine may be a sovereignty ancient, kadim, ancient, imperishable, and everlasting. Ancient means pre-existent again. So the soul of the manifestation has had these experiences before he came into the body. But we will have pre-existent experiences after we leave the body. That's the question. If the soul is pure, it will partake of eternity. And eternity is both ways. I mean, in a sense, you don't miss anything. Though we've come onto the scene in time, yet ultimately, as we become divine souls, in that sense... All right, shall I talk about something? This is my understanding of it. Don't take this as gospel. It's not written in that exact way. You have to take the parts and see whether you agree with the cake after you make it. Well, I think it's pretty much that way. But I don't feel it's reasonable to think it's over. It's my personal understanding and reading of the prophecies of Shoghi Effendi. Because it seems that there's some coincidence of the height of persecution and then the fall of the clergy. And we haven't seen that happen yet. So I don't know whether we'll have another round or what. We don't know what will happen. We pray that it won't be that way. We just don't know. Obviously, the situation now is very dangerous for the Baha'is again, because there are elements there that are very fanatically against the cause. There are other moderate elements. We don't know who's going to get into the position of control. But we can be sure of one thing, that Baha'u'llah's hand is in it. Even in his past, he uses both the good and the evil of the world to promote his cause. We'll have to wait and see.
I really want to understand this manifestation. Okay? Manifestation, if this pre-existent soul comes into this human personality, this human frame, and the human personality is unaware of the pre-existent soul, and then at some point in that life, suddenly the human personality becomes aware of that pre-existent soul and all that, those divine bounties or that knowledge starts coming through. Before that, it's not appearing. I mean, you know, Moses was a murderer and Jesus was tempted for 40 days and then suddenly they became aware of that they were pre-existent, or
You know, he says he has Moses do this as a test to the people. He was acting under the will of God. Baha'u'llah says clearly in one of the tablets in the Gleaning that you must not disassociate any acts or deeds or words, anything associated with the manifestation of God, except with the will of God. Now you can say, okay, that means what, after he's the manifestation or before? But there's no before, as far as I understand from the writings. I don't believe that that reading is correct, that you say that he didn't know beforehand. In one sense, maybe he didn't know what his whole mission was going to be, but as far as knowing that he was different from the other people and seeing his state as quite distinct and having some cognition of...
But he does say, I was like a man, like you, and then suddenly low diseases.
Yes, well, he seemed to be acting like a man like the others. He was living his life and getting married and...
Even after he became aware of the pre-existing soul, he still suffered and he was saddened and he was angered at times. And stuff. Is that human personality? Is that God? I mean, how do you continue to distinguish that?
I think you have to look into the, again, in the chapters of Semantic Questions, even God addresses rebukes against the prophets. He says they're really not against the prophets, they're against us. It's too hard to tell us. So he chides the prophet. Why are you doing this? Why have you done this? And he's getting at us. The manifestation is something so special. I don't know. I think you just have to keep reading all the circle of writings about it over and over and see where it comes out. He's not an ordinary kind of a person in any way, at any stage, as far as I can see.
So when he gets angered or saddened or tired...
Well, that's God, anger and sad and tired, in a sense. I mean, it's a reflective of... The human is there. There's a human element because of the physical body. He can get exhausted. He has resources beyond that to do whatever he wants. But he submits to the human condition, you know? And that's part of what he's saying here is the veil. This is the mysterious thing. Why does he do this? He does it in order to test the people, in order to see who will recognize this purity and this divine power in him. Not because he's able to change a drop of water into an ocean in front of their eyes, or fly around and over the top of the building, or some other... But because his words touch the hearts of the listeners to the degree that they want to transform their lives and are willing to sacrifice themselves from then on for the truth that he bears, you know, for his integrity, for his purity, so on. What about the influence of Baha'u'llah in these meetings before he was a manifestation, while he was a disciple of the Bab? What about the man who came to him in Baghdad and said, I recognize you from the dreams that I had, before he had experience in Sayyid Shah, and he says, yes, it's true and you shouldn't say anything. Recorded in the Dawnbreakers. What do we do with a story like that? Time-wise, it's before Sayyid Chawla, when we're told he received his mission. And yet he seems to be fully aware of it at the time he responds to these individuals. I don't know, it's a mysterious subject. It's not easy to resolve and settle in one way or the other. There are arguments for both points of view. But... I suggest we take particularly these statements about the manifestation of God here and weigh them.
I think that we should also take into account the audience that the manifestation is speaking to at the same time. When he's saying that, and Mawla is saying that, sentence that I was as a man before you, I think that's in those four times he's talking to the Shah of Iran. And it has a different purpose he's trying to convey. It's like the Bab, you know, he had said that he had communicated with Khordud before, you know, to switch around. And yet, you know, it was in Shiraz where he actually, you know, on the second floor of his house where for the first time. I mean, in different times, he says different things to different people because for different reasons, at the level of their understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they're necessarily contradictory, but just like, you know, when you're having a discourse, you say to say the same thing or talk about different topics to a child or a youth or an adult in different ways. I don't think that a student has to do just different topics and saying the same thing.
And also say how could you refer to the suffering of the human side of a manifestation. It's something that we don't understand why. And to understand the beginning of 142, right, the first paragraph talks about this human suffering, but it's kind of nothing to the manifestation. And then in the second paragraph it talks about this real suffering comes from knowledge about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's the part of the manifestation. The kind of why does he suffer in a normal way so that we still can see him? The suffering is kind of nothing compared to real suffering which goes on by, you know, which comes from his knowledge about what's happening. That is, the ones who believe in him are doing all this stupid things. That's what it's like.
He rises in the world, he proclaims his cause, he suffers all the effects of that. And the effects of it are worse than anything we suffer. He calls on us to arise and proclaim his cause. Would we be in a position then to say, well, it's easy for you to tell us to do it. I mean, you had all this divine power and you just got out of all the trouble just like that. And now on us, it falls on our heads. If we want to teach the faith, people beat on us and put us in prison and starve us and hang chains on us. No. He's done it all before us. He has submitted to it for the sake of the glory of the cause. And he calls on us to do the same thing. But he doesn't call us to do anything that he hasn't suffered himself. If you can find a pioneer that suffered like Baha'u'llah or Abdu'l-Baha or the Bab, no, this is mysterious, but it's the way they've shown us by their example. Well, we're just beginning to enter into this picture. What are these mysterious beings, the manifestations of God? And we're going to have, this is the kind of the heart of the book, I think, these next 5 or 10 pages here, really. In Lights of Guidance, I think you'll find letters that will affirm the question of the soul coming into being at the moment of conception. And the soul is the individuality. Of course, it's not developed. It just begins developing then. But there's a mysterious tablet from Abdu'l-Baha where he wants to explain, and also in a talk in the West, he has a parallel explanation. He wants to explain how one receives the gifts of the Spirit, the gifts of the Holy Spirit. That is, this breath of life that we read about that comes with the Word of God. How does it come to us? And he says that the gifts of the Spirit encircle the human soul in the same way that the powers of the soul encircle the human embryo and await capacity to make their appearance. In other words, the human soul is the generating power for the growth of the embryo. Baha'u'llah says the soul is the sun and the body is the earth. The whole life of it, it's the magnetic attraction of it, of everything that happens there, is dependent on the sun. And the soul is not in the body, just as the sun is not in the earth, but through its influence creates life in the earth. Now, we have the human soul, the powers of the soul surrounding this physical counterpart of its being and gradually impressing upon it its powers and gifts. What is it that makes the soul grow, that makes the human body grow so that the soul can act through it? You see, most of us, if we're thinking in terms of the body grows up so it can attract the soul. I mean, that a lot of outer philosophies are that way, or they simply say that the mind is a product of the brain. You know, consciousness is a result of the growth of the human body. It's a complete distortion of things. Things are first spirit and then become matter. we see affirmed in the writings in so many ways. So in that sense now, you have to develop the physical being to the point where the powers that are latent in the soul can appear in it. And some of those will be physical powers. But later they will be spiritual powers. At conception, the human soul comes into existence. Okay, the individual soul. Now, there must be many laws related to that that we don't have any idea about. Because each soul potentially is an expression of all of the names and attributes of God. In a different display in each one of us, but they're there. So even though it is apparently a microscopic seed, if you will, or spiritual seed, it has all this potential. And it is a dynamic power which then sets the body in motion, or sets the physical atoms in the womb in motion and begins to configure them until they take on the form of an embryo and then animate that embryo to live. If the spirit pulls away from that, the embryo disintegrates and dies.
But
this is a potential of the spiritual world, as far as I understand. It's part of spirit. Spirit is universally divided. Spirit is the reflection of the, if you will, of the being of God in the world of existence, or the emanation of God in an outer state, which is nothingness compared to the state of God, but it reflects like a mirror the glory of his being. And it has potentially all of these realms of being. Spirit is universally divided into the mineral and the vegetable and the animal and the human and spirit of faith and divine spirit and so on, all these stages. These are powers of spirit. That power of the human spirit exists everywhere already, but it becomes individualized through conception. This seems to be what we can understand by it. But not as an individual consciousness or reality. It's like a raw material. I mean, this is what we would have to understand from it.
There's an image in Hinduism of like an ocean and taking a drop from the ocean. It assumes individuality, and then it becomes pure enough that it returns to the ocean and loses its individuality.
Yes.
That's
not upheld by the teachings. The first part is upheld by the teachings. In a sense, I think you could say that there are hints to that nature. But there is a specific letter in which Abdul Baha answers this question. He says, you must not think that this is like a drop going back to the sea and disappearing after death, because it retains individuality. He said, look at the human body. It is one body, and yet how many individual cells it has, all of them alive within the body with their own individuality. Now, he gives us that example to give us some hint of what the kingdom must be, you know, how we're organized, that we have individual consciousness, and yet we're cells in the divine body of the celestial world, if you will. How to understand that?
Coming from an ocean is an appropriate metaphor?
Well,
but not coming from this body, this individual self.
The point is that we're never out of that. You know, he says that the soul is not in the body. The soul is an all-encompassing reality. Now, how it becomes individualized, these are very profound questions, you know. You wrestle with them, you can see them from one aspect, one facet. I don't want to be making pronouncements on them. I'm just sharing with you some of the things that I pulled together in my mind when I think about the subject. This gentleman wants to ask me. I think it has to be related to that. You know, there's nothing comes from nothing. Again, we're told we are emanations of God. Now, perhaps with that emanation of that is us is potentially there, but it becomes a human soul. It becomes a center of consciousness at some stage.
So can I
this is the same, this has the same overtone. You see, you weren't created then and yet you were created then. There's something in you, innate in you, that heard that. And yet it's not your it's your individuality now, but before, what was it? We don't know what it is. It's mysterious. But it says as if the soul can remember, you know? It might be something like that, or it might be that there is, you know, a preordained character to each one of us that has something to do with inheritance as well, spiritual inheritance. There's a hint of that in the Will and Testament, where he says that if the guardian son is not the secret essence of his sire, he can't possibly be talking about his physical being. He's talking about something spiritual that one inherits. You see lines of great Baha'i families, I mean, where they really have qualities that grow. Are there? I don't know what the laws are behind things like that, but one could well ponder on it. Doesn't always work that way. Look at the children of the manifestation. Some of them are outstanding. Others are complete losses. You know? Now go back over that once again. That sounds like an important question. Yes. Oh, it seems to work a little differently than that. You've got, let's say, Bill Sears used to use the example of numbers, you know. Maybe you've heard him say this. Let's say that you have been given endowments to count to 100. Whereas the rest of us mortal souls, most of us have been given the endowment to count to 15. And as you survey the human condition, you realize that you are far superior with your capacity to count to 100 than the other souls. So you rest on that, those great gifts you've been given. But ultimately, you never count to more than 15 because there's no need to. Nobody else can count more than 15. Makes us all equal, you see. Now, is God going to judge you with a capacity to count to 100 who never counted past 15 in the same way that the one he's given capacity to count to 15 who counted to 15? You will be judged on what you did with what you've been given. That is justice. Not how you did with respect to anybody around you. That's not the system of God. There's letters about this from the guardian too. No. And the rub in this is you can't judge yourself either. You know? Beware lest you think I'm better than the others because you don't know how much you've been given. Maybe you've been given a whole lot more and you're doing nothing with it and you're in real trouble. You see? But you say, gosh, I do more than everybody in my class, or I do more than everybody at my job, or I'm one of the most active Baha'is in my state. What more could God want, you know? Nobody else is doing anything, you know? No, that's not enough. In fact, the only solution for that is to hitch your wagon on the star of the Master. Look at the Master's example and see how far you are from it and keep pushing towards it. That's the only safe course, I think, that I can think of in relation to what you should do with the capacity you've been given. But if we look at each other, who knows what we'll imagine. And you don't know what anybody else has been given. You don't know. The other thing is sometimes we tend to think because of the physical or outer social circumstances of a person that their capacity to count is very small. That's a mistake. What is this, the old saying? Good things come in small packages sometimes. You find it.
A greater capacity is nothing to be prided in, right? Or lower.
No, it's big trouble. I think it's, you know, that's a big worry, because you have to use that capacity to its fullness. If you're going to, your expression of gratitude to God would be try to do something with the potential that you've been given. And if your role, He's destined that your role should be a certain kind of spiritual influence, is after all, that's the only role that we're ambitious about, is to be able to help other souls recognize Baha'u'llah, lead them to the faith, you know. You're talking about capacity in teaching. It's a pity if we have great capacity as teachers and we don't exercise it at such a time as this. Anyway, that's... Don't worry about it. This is the point. Look at the Master and try to be like he is and leave it in the hands of God. Can't really figure it out, you know. And on the grounds that you might come up with a false appraisal and fall short and get yourself in real trouble, better you say, I want to try to be like the Master. Then that's impossible, but you strive for it in every way that you can. And you see imperfection in yourself at all times. The Master says that the proper attitude for the owner of a large house, beautiful mansion, when he has guests and the guests just swoon, they say, my heavens, what a beautiful house, what a lovely design, how beautifully appointed your house is. And the man says, thank you very much, sir. You're very kind to me, thank you very much. While he's doing that and accepting graciously the compliments of the people, he's thinking inside himself, if I don't get the termites out of the porch under which these people are standing, the next guests that I have are going to fall right through the floor. And what about that crack in the eye in the upper bathroom that's being caused by the dripping water in the attic? And the whole thing has to be painted again next year because the paint is starting to peel. And the other thing is happening in the kitchen. And you know all the faults. You know, but it looks like a beautiful house to the other people. But you know the details. And he says the owner of the house will fix his mind on these things that have to be taken care of. And as soon as he gets one fixed, he discovers another one. And you just keep your attention fixed on what has to be repaired. You're going to sit back and say, yes, what a beautiful house this is. And it comes crashing down on your head, you know. Now the other example that I used to hear, we used to hear when I was a young Baha'i, is they said, okay, that we're all moving towards God. He who serves most is nearest to God. Now if you serve with the right quality, it's because you've turned your heart and your being to God, and you're drawing from Baha'u'llah this power to serve, and you're serving. And your devotion is fixed on that light. But if you should allow yourself the indulgence for just an instant to turn around and look behind you to see how big your shadow is because you're close to the light, and then you suddenly become fixed with a fascination about, I'm this close to the light, look at, I'm overshadowing millions of souls, whoa. Now they said this is like all of us are climbing up the mountain to get to the top. We're climbing and climbing and climbing. And the guy up ahead turns around. He says, I'm at the head of the group. And he looks back down. But because everyone is moving very fast, if he stops and looks back, suddenly the crowd climbs over his head. And they go on and they leave him. They can just climb right over him and go on. Now this is the question of the covenant breakers. They become fascinated with the influence that they might have. And this is a grave danger to the soul too. But it's not a reason for not striving to become the closest to the light. to move, to be as close to the light as you can. That's your responsibility. That's our responsibility as Baha'is. You'll hear some fanciful tales amongst our fellow believers about, oh, we don't want to put so-and-so on the committee. It might be a spiritual test to them. You leave the spiritual test to God. Don't worry. You put the best people for the job in the jobs and let them and God figure out what kind of test they're going to have and how it's going to be good for their soul or bad for their soul. How many times you hear this thing? The Baha'is, in a kind of unfully conscious jealousy, say, well, that might, you know, it's going to swell their head if we give them that to do. So let's give it to this person who we know won't be able to do the job anyway. There'll be no trouble for him. Or, I mean, what are we talking about? If people show capacity, encourage them, support them, help them, let them move forward. Pray for them, because there are dangers for that. But don't stop them from serving because of it. Let them go on. They will learn. Don't worry, God will fix them too. He has his, you know, he creates tests, Baha'u'llah sends his tests, just suited to the moment of the soul. All of us have a test right now. There's something about us that is not acceptable to God, and we know very well what it is. And many times we say to ourselves, this thing I'll take care of after I take care of these other things, because this is easier to take care of. I don't want to face that one right now. But that one is the one that's right there, and it's the next one on your agenda, and it's what has to be dealt with. And if you turn away, you're delaying the whole process. But you say, well, there's these other shortcomings I'm working on. No, I've done very well. Don't you think I've done very well with that? And over here, I've been doing really quite a good job with it. You know, this one? Really? This one I have to deal with now? Some of us don't really like even think what it might be. We know it's there. It lurks there like a shadow. You know, we say, oh, goodness, what? You go to the shrine of Baha'u'llah and you say, sometimes you go there, you don't see anything that you can offer him, you know?